I want to apologize to you. As you know, punctuality is not my strongest virtue. But I was here for at least 5 minutes. It was so quiet in here. I said, all right, nobody came. What's going to be? So you were just being good. Okay, sorry. So I'm going to tell you a story that some of you have heard, some from me, some from other people. But you'll live through it. Okay? And there's a reason I'm retelling this story. My friend Sarah Rigler lives in a house that's 500 years old in the old city. She fixed it up. Okay. So it's very beautiful, but she discovered a disadvantage, which is she has a set of trays that hang from the ceiling in the kitchen. She puts fruits. It looks very beautiful. She noticed teeth marks. She drew the conclusion they weren't human teeth marks. They were little teeth marks, that there's a rodent around. So she called an exterminator, and he looked at the fruit. He said, it's a rat. So he put poison down, like in the area below the sink that's like a floor where the pipe is. There's always an empty space around the pipe so the plumber can get at whatever has to be done. So he poured poison down there, and it didn't kill the rat. But he took this personally. It became him against the rat. So he came back. I'm not making up this name, by the way. The extermination, the most popular extermination company in Jerusalem, really is called Shalom Bayit. Okay, so the man from Shalom Bayit came. And just seeing him, like, should have scared the rat. It scared me when I saw him the first time. He's a Breslover Chassid, big beard, big payas, a mask on his face because of the poison, and tanks on his back, and then he carries a stick that he sprays the poison with. Now, if you heard a knock on the door, and that's what you saw when you opened it, like, whatever. So he came with more poison, new poison, more toxic poison. He poured it down. It didn't work, and he saw this again as a personal insult. So he researched more, and he discovered that rats can't resist persimmon. So he bought a sophisticated trap, and he told Sarah to buy persimmon, and put persimmon in the trap. Okay, so far the story makes sense. Now we'll get to the part that gets a little funnier. Okay, so she was in the bedroom, straightening up or whatever during the day, and she heard a snap, and she knew that the rat's in the trap. So because women don't always think rationally, she was afraid to go out of the bedroom. How many of you could understand this? So she called her husband, who's not the type for this, and she said, Leib, you have to come home. So he says, why? And he says, because the rat's in the trap. I can't go out. I can't bring myself to go out of the bedroom. So he said, wait a minute. Think. When the rat wasn't trapped, you weren't. And now, like, okay. But do you think that helped him? No. Okay. So he came home, and by the time he got home, the rat had sprung the trap. The persimmon was gone, but the rat figured some way to open the trap and was gone. Okay, so later, she and her husband and their two kids, who were like in their early teens then, were sitting down having dinner. I bet they didn't eat the fruit. But in any case, and the kids, because kids take things to a certain place. They take things to like the most adventurous, not always most logical place. They decided that the rat has got to be a Gilgal. That it's for sure a Gilgal. And you hear these stories, that there was the man, and like the dog followed him to shul every day, and finally the rav said to say Michael, and then the dog went away. Okay, you know these stories. So the kids are convinced that the rat is a Gilgal. And when you hear things enough times, it sounds true. So she also became convinced it's a Gilgal. The only one who's not convinced is her husband. He's still there, like, are you sure that you're afraid to go out of the room when the rat is trapped? He's still thinking rationally. So he told her, listen, I'm not going to a rabbi to ask who the rat was in its previous life. This is not going to happen. It's like, let's let go of this. How many of you think he ended up not going to the rabbi? Come on. So there he is with her by Rav Scheinberger in the old city. Rav Scheinberger was a real Mekubal, the real deal. And she tells the whole story. And he says that the rat is not a Gilgal, and it doesn't need a tikkun. You need a tikkun. So she says, what? And he says, you complain too much. Okay. So this is stewing in her head. Now, at that time in her life, one of her kids weighed a little more than that child should have weighed. So the pediatrician said it's important for the child to exercise. So getting children to exercise is very hard, as you know. So what happened is her method was that the child was going to school outside of the old city. So just walking to school and walking home would be enough to exercise. But so the child even agreed with this. But how many of you believe you should exercise and do exercise? Let's see. How many? I want to see. Okay, one. Okay, two. Everyone has permission to hate them. Okay, the rest of us believe we should exercise and what?
Don't.
Okay, so children are like adults in that regard. So he liked the principle of exercise, but every day was a new story. You know, it's too hot, it's too cold, I'm too tired, I have a headache. So every day she had to entice him to go with her. She would walk with him till the Jaffa Gate. And at that point, it wasn't kedai for him to not go further because he's already halfway there. Okay, then her ritual was, we do rituals without necessarily noticing it. Her ritual was that she would go home, her husband would be finished with davening by then, and she would complain. I can't believe it, it took like 40 minutes to get the Jaffa Gate, every minute he was complaining, blah, 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 blah. And the husband had a ritual answer. Kids will be kids. Okay, have the picture? Okay. So here it is. Comes the day. Same thing happens. She gets home. She's about to start her ritual complaining. And then she remembered that the Rav told her that she complains too much. So instead of complaining, she told the truth. She said, you know, what should I say? It's a miracle we have children at all. They didn't marry so young. She was over 40 when they married. They have two children. And, you know, things could be a lot worse than walking home early in the morning from the Jaffa Gate. Did our great-grandparents have that? No. So, as she's talking about how things really are good, she heard a snap, and the rat was in the trap. Okay, so, why am I telling you this story? In Tehillim, one of the names for the world is Chaled. Hazinu kol yoshvei Chaled. Does this sound familiar to you? If it doesn't, you should feel guilty. It means that you don't say Tillim very often, do you? Okay, so, Kol Yoshvei Chaled, listen all those who inhabit the world. So the Gemara asks, what's Chaled? Why does the word Chaled mean world? Why does the word actually come from? The word that we usually use for world is Olam. Chaled comes from the word Chulda, which means a rat. So the question is, why is the world called a rat? So one of the reasons that are given is that rats have their entire society underground. They have their tunnels and their hiding places for food. So there's a whole subterranean world that they live in, and we don't even know about it. So similarly, in our world, we see the surface, and we think we're seeing the whole thing. But the fact is, we don't see what's going on below. We don't see all of the inner workings of the world at all. So the word Chaled is meant to describe very much what the word Olam also describes. The word Olam is related to He'olam, which means concealment. So the idea is, all we see is the surface, and we don't see what's going on underneath. Okay. Part two. Okay. So, not that this is a moment for true confessions, but when I was a child, there was something called movies that some of you may have heard of, in which there were images on a screen and that they would, okay, whatever. Now, these movies would be shown in a place called a theater, okay? And the theaters in those days, I don't know what movies theaters are now, if they still have them, because people watch movies on computers, I would imagine. But the movie theaters then were very, very regal. They had names like Granada, you know, they had pillars, plush seats, heavy upholstery, big ceilings. So part of the experience was just going to the movie house. So if you come early to a movie in a movie house, what happens is you see the end of the movie before you see the beginning. And then when after the end finishes and you see the film credits, you see the beginning. So you know how things will end up before you know what happened. So one of the mysteries of this world and the tkufa that we're in now is we know the end, but we don't know what the lead up to the end is. So what's the end? What do we know? We do know that the world has a pattern in its development, which is modeled after the Sheshes Yimei Bereshis. So the first 1,000 years of human history parallels the first day of creation. The most central thing in the first day of creation was light. The most central thing in the first 1,000 years of world history was this, that there was a human being there. Adam lived to be 930 years old. That filled up most of that box called the first millennia. Humans are beings of light. What do I mean by that? If this room was completely dark, nothing would change. The seats would still be green, the camera would still be over here, but you wouldn't see it. Humans are the only beings that could see and interpret reality. So if an ant was to be in the Grand Canyon, it wouldn't see the Grand Canyon. What would it see? It would see the rock right in front of it. Humans can see. So seeing parallels the trait called chachma, the ability, koachma, the ability to say, what is it and what does it mean? So this kind of light characterized the first 1,000 years of the world's history. Up until then, there were all these other creatures, but now there's a being that could say, what is it? Okay, the second day of creation was one in which the upper waters were separated from the lower waters, forming the rakia. How many of you ever use the word rakia in normal conversation? Did you ever hear anyone use the word firmament for any reason at all? Okay, like, how are things? Well, the firmament's kind of funny today. Okay, whatever. So this empty space parallels what? Water is the source of all life. Everything that grows is fully dependent on water. Our bodies are 86% water. But the source of the water, the physical water that we have, is Hashem's will to give life. So Hashem's chesed is called the higher waters. H2O is the lower waters. The space between these two, the spiritual source and the physical expression, is called the empty place. So that empty place is what gives birth to free choice. So you know in nature there's a rule that you might recall. Nature abhors a vacuum. Remember this? So this empty space is in one's heart. On one hand, you know that Hashem is the source of all things. On the other hand, your body desires all sorts of things. And there's an empty space and you fill it either with emunah or with what? Or denial. It doesn't stay empty. So on the second millennia, what was the major event, which is indeed one of the most major events in all history? The Great Flood. So we have this like very romanticized picture of the Great Flood, you know, Noah on his archy-archy where the animals went two by two. Okay, whatever. But it was the worst calamity to ever happen in world history. And the reason why there was such a calamity is that there was a separation. Except for Noah and the few people of his family, people saw this world as being all that's real. They lost track of there being a higher world. So this led to the separation between the few who saw and the many who didn't. And that was the main event in the next 1,000-year period. Third day of creation. On the third day of creation, all vegetation, plants, trees, flowers, everything sprang forth from the earth. What happened in the millennia after the flood? In 1,000-year period, you have the lives of all of the Avot and Imahot, the descent to Egypt, the formation of the Jewish people in Egypt, that's when we become Bnei Yisrael, the plagues that demonstrated that Hashem is there, that he cares, and that he could break his own rules, the giving of the Torah, Okay, everything that took place in the desert and the entrance to Eretz Yisrael. This was all in 1,000-year period. So that 1,000-year period is called the era of fruition, paralleling the fruition of everything that was on the physical earth. Next 1,000-year period. Okay, on the fourth day of creation, you have God creating the sun, the moon, the stars, all of the heavenly bodies. This parallels the era of the two Batei Mikdash. The first Beit HaMikdash was compared to the sun. It endured for 410 years. There was a 70-year break. Then you have the second Beit HaMikdash, which was compared to the moon, which endured for 420 years. So together, again, that filled up most of the box. But here's where this gets sticky. Those of you who were in the Veil like 5 million years ago when it first started may remember her. There's a girl called Tzipora Schwartz. Do any of you know who she is? You know her, yeah, see? She's 31, okay? It must be because this must have happened 30 years ago. Okay, whatever. So there's a girl called Tzipora Schwartz, a brilliant, brilliant girl. She was blind almost since her birth because she was premature. And in those days, they didn't know that the oxygen levels in the incubators would destroy the retina of the eye. Today they cover the baby's eyes with cotton wool. So she has no memory of sight. Okay. Nonetheless, she's very independent, very self. I saw her once shopping in Geula, which already to me, for a person who can't see, even for a person who can see, how many of you could cross the street in Geula on Friday without feeling like you should say Birkas HaGomel when you get to the other side? Okay, you know, like, there's like no hasaga thing, basic things like he should stop if he sees you crossing. Like, not necessarily move on, may love. Okay, so in any case, she's shopping in Geula on Friday. She was in a clothing store. She asked the saleswoman for a dark blue skirt. The woman handed her a couple of skirts. She went into the dressing room. She put one on. She came out. She asked people in the store, does it look good? Okay, then she asked about the shade, like, will this look really okay with an off-white shirt? Okay, now, I'm listening to this, and I realize she doesn't know what she's talking about. She doesn't know what dark blue is. She doesn't know what off-white is. She memorized this, okay? So that's how we are with the Batei Mikdash. We talk, and we don't know what we're talking about. So the kind of light and energy and spiritual closeness that people had in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, we could talk about it, but we don't know what we're talking about. We get up to the fifth millennia. So on the fifth day of creation, what came forth were the low-level animals, birds, insects. The fifth millennia was the era of what we'll call the lower-level empires. The empires that conquered for the sake of conquest, that had no underlying ideology. Now we're up to where we are today, the sixth millennia. What was created on the sixth day of creation? Man. Higher level animals and humans. This millennia is the era of the higher level empires, the ideologically oriented empires. Think democracy, think socialism, think communism, think jihad. These are all ideological motivated empire building. Okay, but it concludes, and this is what I mean when I said we know the end of the movie. It concludes with the world becoming human. Ramban, who brings us all of this, and it's in the Gemara as well, explains that the one who's called the man is Mashiach. He says this using Daniel as a reference. So the end of the story is Mashiach will come and bring us back to a place of being more human. So if I came today to speak and I took my friend Sophia the ape with me, see, pretend you see her. Okay, so here, what are some differences between Sophia and me? Right, she's hairier. Otherwise than that, we're the same. We're exactly the same. She's hairier. So if I was, you know, do any of you see any other differences? This is not a good sign, is it? What? I could speak about abstractions. Animals make noises that convey the immediate. I could talk about abstractions. Tell me more. She's hairier and less verbal, that's it? Okay, hopefully intellectually we're on a different place. Okay, I could think abstractly, I could think logically, I could move, I could think about things that are spiritual. Yeah?
She doesn't have feelings.
She doesn't have sophisticated feelings. Okay, she isn't creative. Okay, she isn't aesthetic. She doesn't have to have matching bedspreads to her curtains. Okay, she works on instinct. She doesn't make moral choices. There are a lot of differences. So when you're talking about the world becoming more human, you're talking about powers coming about to bring us to a place of greater connection to the spiritual, greater creativity, greater capacity to make moral choice. So this is where we're headed. But it's Chaled. All of the inner workings of how and when are concealed under the earth's surface, and we don't know what the process is so much. We know the end of the story. We don't know that much about the process. I want to talk to you a little about the process, and this will take us into understanding Chanukah better. So of the Rishonim who discuss... To discuss Mashiach's coming, in fact, not of the Rishon. The only Rishon who talks about Mashiach's coming is Rambam. And here's how he describes it. He says there'll be a leader, Ramchal. What's the function of this leader? The function is to teach each of us to be who we could be. We all know it holds us back from being fully human. We all know the Sophia part of ourselves, right? If you could press a button and become more human, in the fullest sense of this word, you would press that button. Most of us have a history of failure. We try, we fail, we try more, we succeed, try again, fail. Okay. The role of Mashiach is to be able to walk into who you are and tell you how to be the person you want to be. And from there to work into the world and guide the world to being the kind of world we all want. So if you were to ask, what's wrong with the world as it is, tell me five things that are not good about the world as it is today. Okay, I'll go down. Three things. No. Murder is no good. Tell me more. Immorality is no good. Anything else? Theft, cruelty, no values. Okay. So was this always true about the world? Yeah. Now, people want things to be better. Were the Greeks able to solve this? They were great philosophers. Were they able to solve these problems? No. Were the Romans? No. Is Obama likely to figure this out? No. Okay. So, the solution to all of this is called Tikkun Olam. The rectification of the world, and Mashiach is there to guide the world and the individuals in the world towards tikkun. So to understand how. So Gemara tells us you should know Mashiach's name. Is that a helpful statement? So it gives us a few havaminas, maybe this, maybe that. So one havamina, maybe his name is Menachem. Okay. Maybe his name is Chizkiah. But then Ravi Ami says, maybe his name is Ami. And then Rav Shiloh says, maybe his name is Shiloh. And then the final Havamina is, maybe his name is Barnepli, the miscarried child. The miscarried child. So Maharal explains this. When you're talking about something's name, you're talking about what it is essentially. So maybe Mashiach's essential role is to bring comfort. Maybe his essential role is to bring strength, that we feel strong enough to overcome ourselves and be who we want to be. But maybe his role is to tell you that you could be you. That Ami could be Ami and Shiloh could be Shiloh. And we are warned that there are going to be a lot of disappointments, a lot of people we think is Mashiach who in the end isn't. Okay, so I want to tell you a midrash that makes this a little bit clearer. And then we'll bring this into Chanukah. So here's the Midrash. It's a Midrash from Echa Rabbah. Okay, there was a man. He was busy plowing his field. He has two oxen. They're plowing. An Arab comes by. Now, as the Arab comes by, one of the oxen bellows. So the Arab says, you know, you may as well untie your oxen from the plow. Nothing's going to come of all of your plowing and planting. You're finished. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So the man is so distraught, he actually does what the Arab tells him to. He lets go of everything. And then the second ox bellows. And the Arab says, you could tie him to the plow, start planting again. Mashiach was born. Okay? So then, this man, who now has tied his oxen to the plow, and he's beginning again, he looks at the Arab, and he says, what's his name? And he says, Menachem. He says, what's his father's name? He says, Chizkiah. He says, where is he? I want you to hear the answer, because it's a strange answer. He's in Bethlehem, which is in Arabia. Bethlehem in Arabia? We all know where Bethlehem is. You get on the 163 bus, and it's like 10 minutes from Gila. What do you mean, Bethlehem in Arabia? Okay. So he says, okay. And he decides he's going to find Mashiach. So he goes journeying, looking for Bethlehem Aravia. And he goes from place to place, and he figures out, what will I do when I get there? So before going any further, he sells his oxen, and with the money, he buys swaddling clothes, little blankets that one wraps a baby in. He says, I'll get to the right place. I'll announce in the public square that I have all of these swaddling blankets to sell. All of the mothers with newborn babies are going to come out and buy, and I'll meet the mother of Mashiach, and then I'll meet Mashiach, and then I'll know where he is. So he does that, and all of the new mothers come out except one. And who is this? Who doesn't come out? Okay, the mother of Mashiach. So he asks, this is still in the same Midrash, he asks, where will I find this other mother? So they tell him. He goes to her, and he says, why do you want to buy any of these blankets? They're like good blankets, whatever. And she says, because my child was born under a star that tells me he'll have bad luck. So he says, buy a blanket anyway. And then he says, and if you don't have the money right now, I'll come back in a few days. Just buy it. So she agrees, doesn't pay him. He comes back 2 days later. And he says, want to pay me? And she says, I told you he has bad luck. And he said, what happened? And she said, a wind came and swept him away. Now, the speaker of this Midrash, who told this Midrash? Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. This is a story told by Shimon bar Yochai, which means it has very deep levels of profundity. But after he told the story, one of the other Amorayim said, what are you telling us this story for? Don't we know this already? Doesn't it say in Navi that the cedars will be uprooted? And doesn't it also say that a sprout will come forth from Yishai? And that's the closing of the Midrash, with a contradiction to the words of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So Maharal explains this Midrash, and I want to take you a step-by-step through this. The first is, notice who the characters are. The man, the oxen, and who else? The Arab. So he begins by discussing the oxen. Why should the oxen know when the destruction has taken place or when Mashiach will come? Why doesn't the man know? Or at least the Arab should know. It's only when the oxen bellow. So the answer is, animals are often more sensitive to reality than humans are. Even physically, I'm sure you've seen this, that there are people who have these whistles that blow on a pitch that humans can't hear, but dogs could hear. So why, and it says, Tzipor HaShemayim Molichat HaKol. Okay, so why do animals understand what humans don't? Because they don't block things with their sechel. What do I mean by blocking something with sechel? Do you all know what cognitive dissonance is? That means when it makes sense this way, and therefore you won't accept it if it's that way. Doesn't make sense this way. So you said it's not there. Can't be. So I'll give you an example of how cognitive dissonance really works, because it doesn't work by somebody saying, this is the truth and I'll ignore it. That's not how it works. It works by our distracting ourselves so we don't have to confront something that we don't want to see or can't see. So I remember once seeing a headline in Yediot, which is like the Israeli garbagey newspaper, okay, that said, Nes B'Netivot. Okay, what was the Nes B'Netivot? I was very curious. I don't normally read Yediot, but that the headline got me. The newspaper had sent somebody to Netivot, where Baba Sali lived, to prove that he's a fraud. That was their intent. So they have an investigative journalist with a budget. Go investigate what's really happening in Netivot.
While he was alive?
While he was alive, of course. So he decided to find, like, somebody who's going to Baba Sali for healing, and he'll, like, record exactly what happens. So he found a man who was blind. Now, his first step was, how do we know this man is really blind? Maybe he's, you know, maybe he's psychosomatically blind or something. So you offer the man money to see his records from Hadassah. The man's blind, okay? Goes to Netivot. Now let's see what happens with Netivot. Maybe, like, just as a headset, maybe he'll just say he could see. Maybe he thinks that that's what he's supposed to say, but he, okay. So he goes there. Were any of you ever to Baba Sali? It was a scene. It was like, in his living room, he would sit at the head of the table. There was like a constant suda going on. Okay, you know, so like a bris or this or that, there's, you know, and there's food going back and forth and water and arak and whatever. Okay, so the man is there. The gabbai lets him in. Baba Sali says a bracha on water and tells the man to put the water on his eyes. Okay, so take some, put it like this. The man did and he was able to see. Now, how do we know he's really able to see? The same investigative reporter had him read a chart, had him read a book, had, you know, the whole works. So you see the headline, Nes B'Netivot, right? I don't know how many people read Yediot every day. Let's say 25. Okay. It's really a very garbagey newspaper, but I'm sure it's not that. I'm sure it's thousands. Do you think anybody changed their lives because of this? Do you think that there were people who said, like, wow, Nes B'Netivot, I think we better be Shomer Mitzvah. You think that happened?
No.
I don't think so. And I want to tell you why. It's not that anybody would say, oh, Nes B'Netivot, I guess this is true. I don't want to acknowledge truth. I think I'll, no one does that. It's Nes B'Netivot, wow, pass me the berekas. You understand this? Es a manyen, okay? So we distract ourselves so we don't see the truth because we're reluctant to let go of our pre-existent ideas. But animals don't have pre-existent ideas. So they can absorb things as they are. So this, to use Maharal's word, is because they're chumri, because they're like matter that doesn't have form. They'll accept form. They're receptive. Lesson number one. When you're talking about the tekufa of redemption, be receptive. Okay. Next, the man's plowing the field. We're trying to take control of nature. Do we do this all the time? Okay. So, could you picture this happening? Suppose Mashiach was to come tonight. Okay. Somebody's saying, "Wait a minute! I'm in the middle of." It's hard. Then the Arab comes. So to understand the significance of an Arab being in the picture and not some other non-Jew, okay, we have to go to Nebuchadnezzar's vision. He had a few visions. One of them involves him seeing a statue. And the statue had a golden head, it had silver arms, a copper body, iron legs, and earthenware feet. So the whole thing topples over. He didn't know what he saw. He knew that it was something big, but he didn't know what he saw in the stream. So he summoned Daniel to interpret it. Daniel said, The head is Bavel. Bavel is the golden head. You're the first person who even conceived of making a real empire. The arms are Persia. Their craft, their aesthetic sensitivities. Okay, but it's all part of an idol. God's not in their picture. The body is Greece. Okay, the iron legs are Rome. And I want you to feel, when you think of the Nazis, doesn't the phrase, the iron legs, evoke what they were?
Yeah.
But the last of all the exiles, the earthenware feet, is Ishmael. So he said, these are the levels of concealment that have to be pushed aside before there's revelation. So let's understand this. Why does there have to be concealment in order for there to be revelation? Bear with me, this part is a little bit hard. The rest is easy. In the creation narrative, it begins by Reshit Bara, in the beginning Hashem created. Do we like creativity? Yes. Do we like the fact that Hashem made everything? Yes. When we were in kindergarten, did we say Hashem is here, Hashem is there? Okay, yes. But then what does it say? Next statement, Va'aret hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech al p'nei tahom. And superimposed upon all this creativity, you have chaos, you have emptiness, you have darkness, you have depths. And only then it says that Hashem said Yehi Or. Only after he created chaos, emptiness, darkness, and depths did Hashem say, let there be light. So what's this about? Hashem created the backdrop of creation, the whole world. But he wanted the world to exist for the sake of humans. What makes humans able to give forth light, not just to see in the light, but to give forth light, is if we contend with darkness. So if you think of any person who you would think, that's a heroic person, that's a person who's the kind of person for which Hashem created the world. Give me an example of a hero.
My friend Tamar asked her daughter's illnesses and heart transplant.
Yes. Okay, her friend Tamar, who's as strong as a pillar after her daughter went through so many medical crises. She is a hero. Give me an example of someone else. Someone who you would say, that's a real hero. Henny Machlis, that's a great example. How many of you know who I'm talking about? Okay, so suppose I never heard of Henny Machlis, so I would say, what's so heroic about Henny Machlis? What would you say? Yeah, you would say, she led hundreds of people into her house. Okay, she extended herself. She had enormous yata deshmaya. She was kind to them. Okay, clear? So the backdrop is hundreds of people who are hungry, many of whom are hard to be kind to. That's the backdrop. You understand this? The Yehi Or was her response to the backdrop. And anybody who you'll think of, if you're going to say this person is great, it's because they put light on the backdrop of dark. Anyone. You look at contemporary heroes. Okay, think of the contemporary heroes who we have. We have great people in the world. Rav Yitzchak David Grossman, who brings light wherever he goes. Okay, Reb Aryeh Levine, who did the same. Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. These people, for them to be who they were, needed the backdrop of darkness. Could you see where this is so? Yes, no? Okay. So, the four exiles are different forms of darkness. So the last one is Yishmael. Yishmael is really part of Galus Edom, just like the feet are part of the legs. So let's understand this. Yishmael and Edom, by the way, were michutanim. You know this, right? Okay. Esav was looking for Shiddach for himself, so he marries Yishmael's daughter. Bashert. Okay, whatever. A shidduch made in heaven. Okay, so whatever. Okay. So they're entwined. Their traits are entwined. Okay, Esav and Yishmael are different. The way Esav is his, what's his bracha? Al charbacha techyeh, you're going to live by the sword. Esav is a hunter who lives by the sword. So I want you to think about hunting. Okay, what makes hunting enjoyable is pitting your own skill and your mind and your body against what? Against prey that's clever and fast. So, did any of you ever know anybody who hunts? This is New York. Of course you don't know anyone who hunts. Okay. So I once encountered somebody who hunts, only once in my life. I was in a different city, and so they brought me there from Aish, and they had a woman like take care of me that day. A lovely, lovely woman. Like, she took me to a museum. She couldn't be a better hostess. And the plan was, after we had dinner, for me to go to her home and to sleep there. I saw as we're approaching her house, she's getting very tense. I'm trying to figure, she clearly is a woman with money. She had, you know, she's very well dressed. It's a very expensive looking car. What could be so bad in her house? Like, does she have workmen in the house? Did the maid not come today? Like, Maya Holyokva. I could see as I'm walking up, you know, like the steps, she's getting really tense. So she turns to me and says, my house isn't what you think it is. So what did I say? My house for sure isn't what you think it is. Okay. So all right, the maid didn't come. So she opens the door, and there's a moose head fitting, facing me. Did any of you ever see a moose head? I had never seen a moose head before. I always thought a moose head was like a human head, but like, you know, different shape and hairy. No, it's big. It's not like a human head. It's big. So I'm pretty verbal, but like, what do you say to a moose? Like, Shalom Aleichem. Like, what do you say? Thank you for having me. I mean, like, what do you say? So I have this like fakey smile on my face. I go in. Okay, she takes me. She wants to take me to the guest room, and you have to go through the living room. And the living room had the whole menagerie. There was a tiger, there was a lion, there was a bear, and I was like... And she asked me, she said, you know, I could offer you two places to stay over tonight. You could be in the guest room, or you could be in the maid's room. The maid's not here. The maid's room doesn't have any heads. Okay, so what did I go for? I went for the maid's room. I didn't want to like go to sleep. Say, remember to say Shema. Okay. So why am I telling you this? I got to know these people a little bit. I don't know them well. The husband's a huge Baal Chesed. He's in a profession in which he makes his services available to people. And he's enormously kind. So I was thinking, it seemed to be such a stira. How could a person like this be a hunter? So I want to tell you what makes people want to hunt. It's about saying, I could be more than the animal is. The animal is faster and stronger, but I'm more clever. So the stronger and faster the animal and the more intelligent the animal, the more gratification there is in hunting, right? So that's why here in Queens, you'll never have somebody with like an ant head mounted on the wall, sitting trapped under the sink. Okay, that won't fly because there's no skill. So hunting another human being is the ultimate sport, and this is Esav. So the conquest, the empire building, the violence, this is the story of the West. If you were to take violence out of Western history, out of their literature and art, what would you have left? Not much. In fact, the way we learned history in high school, I'm sure you remember this, although maybe you don't, because I think people sometimes press a button and delete history. When you learn world history, it's really the history of warfare. This is how they write their history books. Did you notice this? Okay, so that's the West. So they're hunters and al charbacha techyeh. But they had something. They got a bracha. The bracha that Yitzhak gave is, you'll be able to do this. Okay? They have a self. Yishmael doesn't have that much of a self. What does it say in the Torah about Yishmael? Lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot im b'ni im Yitzhak. the son of this slave woman will not inherit. That's what Sarah said. Avram wasn't pleased with this. What did Hashem say? Ki b'Yitzchak yikareh lecha Zara. Only Yitzchak will be called your descendant. Yishmael has nothing. And the result of having nothing is wanting everything. So therefore, the statement that was made in the Torah about Yishmael was Pera Adam, a wild thing that seems human. Not a human who's wild, but a wild thing that seems human. And I want you to hear what more. Yado bakol v'yad kol bo. His hand is on everything and everyone's hand's on him. Meaning, since he has nothing, he wants everything. So what that means, and we see this unfolding because we know the end of the movie. Okay, they want everything. The jihad, ISIS, all of this, what do they want? Everything. In their worldview, there's no room for anything except themselves. Yado bakol. They're viewed as people who are capable of extreme cruelty. In Tehillim, where it says, Save us me ish lo chasid, Rashi says what? Who's the ish lo chasid? Yishmael. Meaning the desire to have it all, to take everything, to leave nothing outside of their empire of being, is something that's so strong that they're capable of any form of cruelty. So this is going to be an extension of Esav. The desire to hunt is there. The sword is there. But the unquenchable desire to have it all is unique to Yishmael. So this is the backdrop. So I want to give you more information about this. How does this look really? So at one point I lived in Malot Dafna, 139, and our building was the last building before the Arabs. We had outdoor clothes lines. Every so often the Arabs would steal clothes off the line. So I once see a teenager. Now the Arabs, by the way, in Sheikh Jarrah, which was the adjoining area, are not poor. It's a very wealthy area. I see a teenage boy wearing a blue shirt, a button-down shirt that says Bet Yaakov HaTzafon. Okay. Why isn't he embarrassed? It's like saying, I am a thief. And I saw he wasn't embarrassed. He saw me see him in the shirt, and he wasn't embarrassed. I didn't know what to do with it in my mind. Another time, we had these like little postage stamp gardens in front of each bottom floor house. My children were young then. I had toys in the garden. An Arab woman came, and remember, they're not poor. She had a sal, a little basket, and she's going from house to house gathering the toys the kids leave in the garden and putting them in her cell. Now this was quite a long time ago. This is close to 30 years ago. I saw her doing this and I ran after her. And I grabbed her by her shoulder. And I grabbed the cell, which today I would not do. Okay. And she wasn't embarrassed. And that's what got me. It wasn't that she stole. People steal. I'm from Brooklyn. But but that she didn't say, oh, I thought you just left it out. It was just like there was this win some, lose some expression on, and there was no shame. One more illustration, I'm going to tell you how I learned to understand where they're coming from. My daughter Chani was volunteering in the hospital. She's watching a Jewish child, gave the mother some respite, and there's an Arab mother and child in the same room. Chani and I both have this habit. We wear watches too loose. See how I watch this? I don't like the feel of the watch against my skin. She doesn't like it so much either. So her watch fell off her hand. The Arab woman sprung, picked it up. Chani thought she was being courteous. The woman put it on her own hand. So Chani said, give me my watch. And the woman says, your watch? It's my watch. What are you talking about? It's my watch. So she began yelling at her, what do you mean it's your watch? It just fell on the floor. She said, what fell on the floor? So she called the security guard. Now, if you're the security guard, you don't know who to believe, right? So he did nothing, which probably in halacha is right, by the way, because the person has to have a proof when they claim that something is theirs, that it's really theirs. So I couldn't figure this out. Where is the shamelessness from? I want to tell you when I figured it out. I write for Hamodia, as you know. So sometimes people write to me with comments about my articles. Of course, always positive. Okay, whatever. But in any case, one of the people who write is a prisoner. He's a prisoner here in America. I never asked him what he's in prison for. And he writes back and forth comments on things that I write. So once, one trip, I figured I should visit him. So I asked another woman friend to go with me. And we went upstate to meet him, since we could bring him some food, make life a little bit better for him. He became a Baal Tshuva in prison. I know his whole life from when he was in prison. I don't know anything from before. So they have a system in prison where they do a count several times a day to be sure that everybody is still there. So I got there right before they began the count. Now there are several thousand prisoners there. So this is going to take a while. They told me, you know, lady, it's going to be an hour. Okay, so I'm in prison for an hour with my friend, and there's like not much to do there. They have a big a room, I'd say twice as big as this, which is where the prisoners eat their snacks. They have a different dining room, and where they have their library, and where they could see guests if guests come to visit them for visitations. So we're waiting in this room, and I decide I'll look at the library. So the library did not have much in it that was of interest, and it was mostly Christian stuff, but I saw there was a Quran. So I figured, okay, I'm going to read through the Quran. I have a whole hour. It's not that thick. I could read through a lot of it in an hour. What do they really think? So whether this is right or not, I'm not sure, by the way. Islam isn't a Avodah Zarah, so I justified it. I'm not sure it was the right thing to do. But it was very interesting. So in the Torah, when we're told to do what's right and not do what's wrong, there's reward and punishment. So the reward is you'll go to the land and you'll draw close to God and you'll be chosen and you'll be prosperous, right? And the punishment is you'll be expelled from the land and you'll be scattered and you'll suffer, right? That's the land. In the Quran, if you're good, you get to be a winner. And if you're bad, you get to be a loser. The worst thing to do is to be a loser. In their minds, the victim of a theft is the loser, and the clever thief is the winner. It's a completely different way of thinking. Do you understand this? So after I read this, I decided I'm going to test it. Now this is not what I did. I would certainly not do this today, but even then it was probably a pretty stupid thing to do. So I was in the old city, and it was late, and there were no Jewish taxis, and I had to get to Shaarei Chesed. So I knowingly took an Arab taxi, which is not so smart. So I asked him before I got in, do you know this and this street? It's a small street that's hard to find. So what does he say? Of course, madame, I drive taxi, I know all the streets. Okay, so we get there. Does he really know this street? Totally clueless, and he's also gaining by circling, you know. So I said, you know, I'm giving you two more minutes. You said you know this street. You obviously don't. That's why you're asking people, where's the street? Mm-hmm. Either you find it or you don't. I'm getting out in 2 minutes. 2 minutes pass. He doesn't find it. I got out of the taxi. So he said, okay, but what about my money until now? You ask people where it is, you'll find the street, but what about my money? So I said, you lost. And you know what? He didn't pursue me. He didn't yell at me. I saw in his eyes he respected me. Uh-huh. They think differently. This is the mentality of Yado Bakol, the Yad Kolbo. Okay, and this is who we're facing. So the question is, why is this the backdrop? And in the story in the Midrash, why is it the Arab who's telling us all of this information about Biat HaGoel? So Rav Dessler says that there are only two core middos. All of the other middos could be reduced to two. You know what they are? Giving or taking. You're either a giver or you're a taker. That means when you confront another person, either your inner question is, what could I give this person? How could I make them feel good? Well, I'll give them a sense of kavod. Or what could this person do for me? What could they do to make my life better? How could I get them to give me kavod? You understand this? You have a choice. And this isn't only with other people. It's also with Hashem. It says, Ezehu chasid. Do you know the end of this mamar? Hamit chasid im kono. Who's the true chasid, the true ish chesed, the giver? One who does chesed with Hashem. One who doesn't have a relationship to Hashem, in which their basic statement is, well, what have you done for me recently, O Lord? Okay, it's, how could I dedicate myself to you? Ma shiv la Hashem. That's our nisayon. Our nisayon is, are we givers, like Avraham, or are we takers, like Ishmael? That's the backdrop. So when you ask, is it what influences people to be givers, what influences people to be takers? So I want to tell you something about giving, which you know. You know this, but people don't say it because it's not nice to say. Whenever you give, you lose. Is that true? If you lose time, or you lose money, or you lose the ability to take care of yourself at that second, you're always paying something to give. You know this. When you were in pre-kindergarten, if your mommy gave you 3 cookies and you give one away, what do you have now? 2. Okay. You have less, but you are more. You understand this? It's about having or being. So the decision now is, what do you want more, having or being? Having or being. And we Jews are good at being. Okay, after the Henkin murders, there was an appeal for people to send money to support the children in the future. Some of you may have seen this ad. In one of the publications, there's an ad from the family. Do not send any more money. Our financial goals have been met. Klal Yisrael has done what they need to do. We're fully capable of being givers. It's in our blood to be givers. We have the ability to be dedicated to Hashem. There are people in unprecedented numbers who are learning Torah Lishma. There are people who are supporting Torah Lishma. There's a level of kashrus that there never was before. This past Shemitah was kept in Eretz Yisrael in a way that it was never kept before, arguably since the time of the Beis HaMikdash. We have the capacity, but we often sabotage ourselves. Is this true? So again, we know, okay, that the darkness causes the light. The more repulsed we are by violence, by grabbing, by the materialistic lifestyle of Yado Bakol, Yad Kol Bo, the egocentricity of that, the more we go away from I have to win and you have to lose, and people do this in their shalom bayit, and people do this with their child raising. We all know the people do this. The more we move away from this and into true chesed, the closer we are to ge'ula. And the Gras says to make this jump from being a taker to a giver, you need emuna. And the final nisayon is the nisayon of emuna. You have to believe, you have to say everything is from Hashem and everything is an opportunity. Otherwise, your motivation to be a giver could be drowned by the immediacy of taking. So the Gemara says that when a person dies, they're asked a lot of questions. I'm not going to take you through all 6 questions. I'll take you through only a couple of them. One of them, Natata v'nasata be'emunah, did you do business in good faith? It doesn't say, were you a thief or not? Let's say you're not a thief. Good faith. Do you really want the other, do you see the other person's financial needs as being as vivid as your own? Do you see the other person's integrity as being as important to maintain as your own? Is there emuna in how you do business? And a parallel question, there are 6 questions, but I'm only telling you this next one. A parallel question is, did you try to have children? What does having children have to do with emuna? What does this have to do with chesed? Everything. So there are countries in the world in which they're very materially prosperous, and they're not even replacing themselves. Did you know this? Mm-hmm. Sweden and Germany are both in negative reproduction rates, and Iran is moving there very rapidly. Okay, so the old, you know, the old tired arguments for birth control, oh, you don't have enough money, how will you manage? The more money people have, the more likely they are to not have children. Why is that? Why do you think it is? I don't want to give. The more this money could buy me what I want, the less I want it. So I remember that this isn't new, it's just getting more. When I was a child, my mother had a subscription to Reader's Digest, which I try to read only things that are decent, so whatever. Yes, I know I just told you I read through the Quran, but yes, I'll read things that are like, you know, whatever. So, you know, and I'd go by plane. The magazines aren't decent anymore. I'm sure you realize this. So I looked for Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest is like, nobody reads it, obviously, because it's aimed at the geritol generation. You should see, like, you have to be 90 or over to enjoy this. Like, they have all these ads for retirement villages, and, you know, insurance.
Burial plots.
Forest Hills, and I don't mean the neighborhood in Queens. Okay. So, but when I was young, it was still a viable magazine. So I remember once I was reading my mother's Reader's Digest, and they had one of their causes. They're formulaic, like most magazines are. So one of their causes was Planned Parenthood. So this is what they had all these years ago. If you figure out how much money you need to raise a child from your first prenatal visit until they graduate from a state university, then, I'm talking about like 800 years ago, then how much did it cost? What do you think? It cost around $100,000 then. I'm sure today it would be much more. So their theory was, so therefore, if you have $100,000, you should have one child. If you have $200,000, you should have two children. So from their svara, okay, nobody should have a large family, right? But their svara was based on the mentality of netila, you understand, of taking. We have to break through this mentality. We have to become a nation of givers to each other and to Hashem. The ultimate gift is the gift of what? Yourself. When you give yourself. So this is why whenever people ask Rav Shteyman, what should we be working on to get out of the mess that we're in? He says every single time, people don't like hearing this, so you don't like it doesn't make the papers, it's all ben adam lechavero. Again and again and again, he says the same thing. It's all ben adam lechavero. Because this is where the test of emunah comes the strongest. So you could see in our generations, we want a relationship to Hashem. The desire to learn Pnimiyas HaTorah is greater than it's ever been. But the acid test is, do you know what you mean? What it really means to be a spiritual striver? That's ben adam lechavero. So going back to our story, so now we understand why it's an Arab. We understand why it's animals. We understand why Menachem, okay, is born in Aravia, but in Bethlehem. That's Mashiach. The last thing we have to understand, the very last thing, is the storm. So there's a storm and we don't see him. So there are all these predictions about how difficult things will be. And there's in Navi, a lot of you are familiar with Navi, so I'm not talking to you about obscure sources in Kabbalah. I'm talking about Psukim in Navi. The Melech Paras and the Melech HaTzafon and the Melech Arav and the fight over Yerushalayim. It's all happening. So our choice now, again, it's like when you come into the movie and you've already seen the end. The choice isn't whether to make it happen or not, it's happening. The choice is who you want to be in this unfolding drama. So that's what I'm going to leave you with. If you have questions, the time is now. But wait, even before questions, tzedakah. Okay, 1 minute, let me get out my little bag.
Okay, one bad, and you'll see it says Zichron Avos on it. This is for the Mishnah Brura, call out my family openly, Ilui Nishmas, my husband. If this interests anyone, besides giving whatever you want to give now, you'll notice there's a paper here. Okay, it's possible to enter a Yisachar Zavulin deal with a young man who's learning Mishnah Brura, which, since we're only talking about a limited amount of time per week, it's not full support, so it's doable. So if you want to, you could sign on, and if not, you could give whatever you want to give or not. That's envelope one. Here's envelope two. Not envelope, baggy. Okay, envelope two is for Leib Ma'achem. I have a very soft, and I'm not collecting this time for the Nevei Kala, I'm going to tell you why. You should all daven. We don't even have one Kala in the Nevei right now. We don't have one Kala, nobody's engaged. So I'm not going to collect Rav Nessa's Kala when there are no Kalas at the moment. So that's why you only get two beds and not three. Okay, so Leiv La'atam has a place in my heart. I want to tell you why. This is a grassroots organization. They work with kids who are at risk, which never, the word at risk is never, they're the kids who pass being at risk, and who are on their way out, hopefully. But they're also the ones who go to the villages and get the girls out. So I feel a strong responsibility there, so we're passing this around also. Okay, so this is Leiv La'achim. I said Yad La'achim, I meant Leiv La'achim. Yeah? So Rav Dessler says no. Okay, any other questions? Yeah. Yeah?
When you're saying about favorite, if a friend came to you and you said, someone said something nasty, or it wasn't really nasty, came across back to them. Should I go and tell that person, by the way, like what you said, or did it come across well to that other person?
Yes, but you have to be sure to tell it in a way in which you're giving them kavod. You could talk later, but you have to think through how they could feel that you believe in them, and that's why you're telling them this. What happened to Hanukkah? So the self-understood message about Hanukkah, I thought, was that Hanukkah is the celebration of light against the background of dark. And it has to do with our being beyond nature and our ability to bring this light. I should have said it, you're right. Okay. Of course, you could always do tshuva. Sure, there's always potential. Yeah? Yes?
What about giving too much?
So giving too much, it's a tricky question. So I'm going to tell you that there are two kinds of giving too much. One is in the eyes of the world. We all have a sense of normal that has to do with what we see around us. So because of this, if somebody gives more than what's normal, we sometimes think that they give too much. So I'll give you an example of what seems to us to be too much that's not too much. And I'll talk about what is too much. Some of you may have heard of Reb Usher Freund. Do any of you know who I'm talking about, Reb Usher? So I want to tell you how I got to know Reb Usher. One of my sons became a chassid of Reb Usher, but that was much later. Okay? Somebody did a mitzvah. There was a mitzvah girl. She called me up on a Friday. She didn't identify herself on the phone. She said she knows this young girl who might be good material for Nevei. Could I have her for Shabbos? So I said yes. She sends this young girl to me, a very beautiful girl, very young. I'm not even sure if the name she gave me was really her name, but whatever. Completely, completely out of reality. She hears voices. She began taking my pictures off the wall. She threw canned goods out the window. Thank God we lived on the first floor. And she was completely crazy. I don't know who sent her. I didn't ask the person for their name. They do have a mental health division of the health services. I could have brought her there, but I didn't want to send a young, beautiful girl who I don't even know her name. I couldn't bring myself to do that.
Shabbos was extremely difficult. My upstairs neighbor, if any of you know Gitti Eisenstark, okay, so she saved me. She took her for half of Shabbos, which I will always be grateful to. But for, like, by Mitzvah Shabbos, I didn't know what to do. So I had a Yerushalmi neighbor. He went over and he says, why didn't you send, the whole neighbor knew about her, really. Why don't you send her to Reb Usher? So I said, great, who's Reb Usher? So he said, he'll take care of anyone. There's no one who will turn away. So I said, you have a number? So he said, yes. So I called the number, I got his gabai. I was honest with him. I said, you know, I don't know what to do with her. I'm afraid to send her to the mental health service. I don't know what will happen to her there. He only had one question for me. Do you have enough money to send her by taxi, or should I come and take her? So of course, you know me, I'm from Brooklyn. I have enough money. So I sent her now. So what I found out later was that at the time, Rabbi Usher had raised tzedakah money, had rented apartments in the Vayako, hired house parents, who could act as like safe houses for people until they're placed appropriately. Okay, so most people would consider that too much giving. What, you're taking hellers crazy? What, you don't have enough mishugayim of your, whatever. And I filed him away. I didn't think about him. Then later, one of my sons came home. He had been going someplace at night, and he walked through the shuk and machan yehuda to the bus. He saw people going to, and grabbing baskets of food, like all of the leftover vegetables from the day, that the merchants had left out for them. So he said, what are you going to do with all these vegetables? Like, you know, how many carrots could a person eat? He says, we're bringing it to Reb Usher's house. So he went to see Reb Usher's house. His house was a regular house in Makor Baruch. Okay, 24-hour food cooking on the stove. Okay, beds and mattresses out for people to sleep. No questions asked ever. So people would say that's too much, but it's not too much. And I want to tell you why, because it's genuinely given. Here's too much. Too much is where I have a need to feel important, and therefore I have a stake in keeping you dependent on me. So I'll give you what I want to give, not because you need it, but because I need it. And that's when people do excessive giving. That's where control comes into the picture. That's where patronizing comes into the picture. So there is such a thing as too much giving. So when people do that, oftentimes they'll be aware of the other person's needs more than they are of their own needs, because they're getting more ego enforcement by giving the other person than they are by than they would be from taking care of themselves. But for most people, I read all these magazine articles that say learn how to say no. Maybe they know different people. The people I know all know how to say no. I call them up. Could you do this? Could you do that? No. Okay.
Why does Moshe have to be from Arabia?
So why do we have to face this choice? Because this is the choice of giving or taking, which is the shoresh of many other things. Either you're like the Arabs, who are Yado Bakol Yad Kol Bo, or you're like the Avos HaKadoshim Avram, who is Rosh HaMaaminim. That's the choice.
So why does Mashiach have? Why does the Beis Lechem in Arabia? Why does Mashiach have to be?
Because redeemability comes from our facing challenge. That's what makes us redeemable. That's also why, Maharal says this, that's also why Moshe had to grow up in Paro's house. The redemption from Egypt had to come on the backdrop of, imagine what it was, how repulsed Moshe must have been by the toeva of Paro's household. The rejection of that is what brought about the Geulah.
Like
Esther. Okay, yeah?
As our neighborhood becomes more and more looking Afghanistan-like, what should our reaction be as we pass Arabs? What should we be feeling? What should we be thinking?
So, as loath as I am to sound like a liberal, okay, if these people have done no harm to you and are living at peace with you, if that's the social reality, which as far as I know it is here.
So far. Yeah.
So far, I'm only saying so far. Then like with any other non-Jew,
Your basic question is, how could I make Kiddush Hashem in my dealing with this person? Yeah.
If you've ever dealt with someone who's, whom you feel like is a taker, like,
yes,
who's always trying to take from you, or there are things that come up and people always end up throwing it on you, and I do mean throwing it.
Yes, yes, you. Yes.
So how do you balance still being kind and giving, and not just the feeling of being taken advantage, but really turning
around? No, but really you are taking
advantage. Really turning around and like, yeah, I just got stuck at this.
Yeah, how did that happen? Yeah.
Or you're dealing with people who need more from you and you take.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you all hear her question?
No.
You want to be a giver, but how do you deal with people who are real takers? There are people who are like sponges. They just want to. Okay. So I have two answers. One you'll like and one you won't. Okay, which do you want? The good one or the bad one? Okay. So the one you won't like hearing is Avraham let himself be taken advantage of. Okay? I mean, like, let's think about this. Here he is. He's old. He's not well. I mean, can't you picture the conversation? Like, what's wrong with your self-esteem? Why do you need to have the doors open? If you really had a strong sense of self and you respected yourself, you would put up a sign. No visitors till. Okay, clear? Why wouldn't he go for that? Because for him, that was what his life was. It says, "V'hu kechom hayom." He was like the heat of the day. Not it was hot. He was, his need to give was so great. But coming from a holy place. That's what you won't want to hear. What you might want to hear, okay, is that oftentimes, but not always, and it's very sticky, oftentimes, but not always, you're not doing a favor to the person by letting them take more than they should and cross lines, because what you're really telling them through that is, I don't trust you to take care of yourself, you don't know how to take care of yourself, you don't know how to do anything, you aren't capable of accomplishing anything. You're enabling them to stay infantilized, which isn't always a favorite to them. So saying things like, we'll do this together, I'll do this if you do that, and we could do it and we could make it work, and a lot of we is sometimes a much better response. But a deeper answer is like this. If you choose to give a lot, it feels good. If somebody dumps it on you, it feels bad. Okay, could you see where this is so? So there's a little ego involvement here that we all have to grow out of.
It's okay to get stuff dumped on you,
usually? I'm saying, it doesn't matter if the request is good for the person and you can do it. Those are two different, you know, these are two, then it shouldn't matter that much if you chose it or if it came to you. Mm-hmm. The rule is, if a mitzvah comes to you, don't waste it. Okay, so if it came to you, you shouldn't feel taken advantage of. It's a gift from Hashem. But we tend to, because we like feeling, I chose to do this. Okay, clear? So there's ego involvement and it's very sticky.
How about when you're dealing with business and you know that you can do a chesed,
mm-hmm,
with whatever you do, but you also have to...
You have to earn a living, that's why you're in business.
Right, you have to earn your living.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have to, you know, put in your time and your family, but you also would like to, like, I would like to help.
So you have to have priorities. Whatever the Torah requires of you comes first. Whatever only you could do, like being your children's mother, your husband's wife, comes second. After that, other things come. So being able to say, I'll give a certain amount to whatever, your miser could be in time and not in money, is reasonable, but after that it's... Tell...
That
Bethlehem, which is our hint at Mashiach. Mashiach is a descendant of Ruth and Boaz, who came from Bethlehem. We call him Bet Halachmi. Okay? That comes, Dafka, when we face up to the fact that we have to contend with that which is Aravia, with the Nisyonos of the Arab world, which is being a taker. Redemption comes from facing up to challenge. The final challenge is living with them. Living with the Ishmaelim. Okay, yeah?
Okay, I have a question regarding that. With the old religion, and you always felt this method in a different way, I always felt that best your method was you do well. the very contradictory to
yes.
speech was easier to himself and certain chassadim, you could really give a lot, as opposed to draining yourself and certain chassadim that are really a drain.
So Maharal says, like what you would say, if Hashem gave you talents and abilities in a specific direction, that's what you should do. However, having said that, sometimes your picture of what you should do and Hashem's picture of what you should do aren't the same. So you don't look for chasadim that don't fit your talents and abilities and capacities. But if Hashem puts it on you, you have to say, I guess I'd better guess again.
How will you like that?
So I'll tell you a true story. So, okay, Rabbi Aryeh Levine got to know the. Do you know who the Baal HaLeshem was? He's a great, great Kabbalist. So he was Rav Yashiv's grandfather. So how did Rabbi Aryeh come to know him? He would be out late at night doing his chassid, and he saw, he could see from the street. In those days, not everybody had electricity. That there was an older man trying to learn by the light of a candle, but it was hard for him to hold the candle, so he went upstairs and said, I'll hold the candle for you. So night after night, he wasn't learning with him, he was just holding the candle. Okay, sometimes for hours on end. Okay, so they got to know each other, the Baal HaLeshem made the shidduch between his grandson Rav Yashiv and Rav Aryeh's daughter. So towards the end of the Baal HaLeshem's life, Rabbi Aryeh, who was still a middle-aged man at that point, okay, went to him and I said, I think I made a terrible life mistake, and I need to know Darkei Tshuva. He says, what are you talking about? He says, when I was young, I learned in Volozhin. I wasn't the best, but I also wasn't the worst. But I see now some of the men who were young men then, who are on my level, are Gedolei Torah. And I'm not, and he wasn't. Okay, he was a great masmid and zen. He had what to say, but he wasn't one of the great stars of the time. Said maybe all of these chassadim I do are just distractions. Maybe I made a mistake. So the Baal HaLeshem said, and this is what's important for you to hear: Hashem does not play bad tricks on people. If He sent you the chassadim, it's because that's your shlichus. Okay.
Regarding all the bad news.
Yes.
I start to feel sick.
Yes.
And I'm still not even over bad news from last year. Like if I hear,
yes, yes.
If I hear anything, even like there's stuff from last year, I'm not 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Yes, yes.
So now when I'm hearing more bad news,
yes.
I totally can't deal with it.
Yes.
I ignore it. I don't want to see it.
Yes.
I don't even want to hear like the good parts, like they made a big wedding for the girls.
Yes.
Like, I don't even want to watch it.
Right.
I can't stomach it anymore.
Yes. It's very human and very normal, but you have to. Yeah, there's no way of getting out of it. I found myself that way also. Exactly with this one. I heard about the murder of the father and son right before the wedding. My first response was, I don't want to hear it. Enough, I don't want to hear it. And I forced myself to watch the clip of the wedding because it softened me. You have to say stop.
But how about the stuff that there's no stopping? Like it doesn't stop. You know, like you're like, well, that was the worst I've ever been. No, that was really
right.
And you're like, no,
you have to complain.
The parents with the kids in the garden, no, that's the worst.
You have to keep on complaining to Hashem about it.
How?
You say enough, of it, but you have to know who to talk to. You have to talk to Hashem.
But I can't. Like, is it okay that I just don't want to? Even with the fire last year, I still cannot look.
Yes.
Hear the wife talk on the phone. I'm like,
yeah.
Are you guys crazy? Like, I can't even handle.
So you tell Hashem, I can't even bear that. You tell him that. Tell him that, but you have to talk to Hashem. Okay, last question. Is it bad to be taken advantage of or not? So it depends. If you're enabling the other person to remain infantilized, it's not good, because it's not good for them as well as not being good for you. If the real issue isn't that it's not good for the other person and you're developing their weakness instead of their strength, but it's that you resent that you didn't make the choice, You're willing to do this. You admit that it's a good thing to do, but you want to be the one who chose it. So maybe hand the control over to Hashem a little bit more. Let him decide which chesed you do. Okay. This is really the last time.
I'm going to be sound really bad. But growing up, you know, with surrounded by Holocaust survivors and everything, you know, throughout history, yeah, even in their time, we heard Mashiach was coming, Mashiach was coming.
Right.
And there were a lot of simanim that pointed to it. So, like, today we hear it, and we kind of know it. But, like, how come throughout all the generations they had perfect simanim to lead them to believe Mashiach was coming? And
see, if a mice in the Gemara with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, you can imagine how long ago this was, he's in a cave, and he comes across Eliyahu HaNavi, and he says, no, when's Mashiach going to come? And what's the answer?
When you're ready.
When you want him.
Uh-huh. That's it. So all these years.
All these years, we just have to do one thing. We have to be ready to change.
And change is not easy.
Okay. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.